Hashtag Sisters in Law is going on tour in May. Get tickets at politicon.com/tour. You can see us live at the Athenaeum Center in Chicago on May 2nd, the Royal Oak Music Theater in Detroit on May 9th, and the Schubert Theater in Boston on May 30th. Go to politicon.com/tour to get your tickets now.
Hi, this is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. What a week, and it is only Tuesday. Let's see if we can manage to collect all the different strands of what is going on. Well, first, we may actually have a deal to keep the government operating. There are supposedly details yet to be worked out, but perhaps we will get that done. That is good news for the country. That's good news for functional government. The other big news of the day is Donald Trump really took a gut punch in New York. This is the trial involving the falsification of business records of the Trump Corporation. It is in state court. This is Alvin Bragg's case. And what we had was a series of rulings on evidence. The fancy phrase is motions in limine. It basically means what's going to come into the trial and what's going to come out. And it was devastating for Trump. He's not going to get to argue that he is falsely singled out, that this is a selective prosecution. Nuh-uh. The judge says, no way, that's not coming in. He's not going to argue that he did this on advice of counsel. That's not coming in. He's not going to be able to say, well, the feds didn't indict me, or the Federal Election Commission didn't file charges against me. That's not coming in. What is coming in is a whole bunch of damaging information. We're going to hear from not only Stormy Daniels, but from another woman who was part of the so-called catch and kill story. That is an agreement that he was making with David Pecker at National Enquirer to collect these stories that were looming out there and threatening his presidential election and pay these women off. We are going to hear about the Access Hollywood tape. And this is critical. It was only after the Access Hollywood tape broke that he became frantic to shush up these women. He didn't want another episode on top of the Access Hollywood. So that Access Hollywood tape is going to get played in court, and people will understand the intent he had, which was to make sure there are no more Access Hollywoods so he could get elected. So it was really a devastating loss across the board. I'll have a piece out on Thursday that'll go through many more of these. So take a look at the Washington Post. But bottom line, he really got slugged on this. And you understand why he is desperate to avoid trial. He knows that the law is not on his side. And he knows that the facts, if they get to the jury, are going to be devastating. And in some ways, this is a very meta experience. He knew if the facts about his affairs got to the voters, they wouldn't elect him. And now he's afraid that the facts about his scheme to boondoggle and boonswoggle his way into office, if that information gets to the jury, he's going to get convicted. So it's always the cover-up with Donald Trump. It's always the attempt to avoid reality. So that is not going well for him. But there is good news if you are Donald Trump. You have possibly the dumbest and least competent lawyer in the federal judiciary, and that is Eileen Cannon. She comes out with one of these doozies after another. Her latest is that she is opining on evidentiary motions and motions that involve the instructions to the jury. Why is she even talking about this? We're eons away. She has to make rulings on matters that have already been raised. The questions and the direction to the jury is not relevant right now. And she presents the case in alternative ways, neither of which complies with the law. This comes on top of her very slow walking of this case. It comes on top of a ruling she still has not finalized, in which the prosecutor says, if you force me to release this information, including witnesses' names, we will have a national security problem. She seems bent on doing that. So what is going on? Is there any relief? Well, it is possible that at some point, we hope it's now, that Jack Smith will take it up to the 11th Circuit on an interlocutory basis, an emergency basis, and say, not only do you have to straighten all this out, but you have to take her off the case. That is not entirely unprecedented. That does happen from time to time. And sometimes, believe it or not, even the circuit will suggest it in sort of a back and forth with the attorney. Well, we're going to have to release this. Do you think it might help further proceedings if you had a different judge? And the lawyer would say something like, well, far be it from me to tell the court what to do. But so that kind of discussion can be had, but Jack Smith has to take it up to the 11th Circuit. Otherwise, this case will never get heard, or worse, it will get to a jury so bastardized and so manipulated that Trump will be acquitted. That's also possible, and that's the worst possible outcome, of course. So we have that trial going on. Meanwhile, the first round of briefing at the Supreme Court on Trump's immunity claim has come in. And Donald Trump, surprise, surprise, says, I should be immune for everything. Nothing I have done should be subject to court review or to a criminal investigation. The Supreme Court is not going to go for that. But I will say this. There actually is an important principle, and Jack Smith is going to have to lead the Supreme Court to this end. Certainly, you don't want criminal trials about every decision a president makes, whether Biden should have given arms to Ukraine, whether Biden should have passed a bill that could have saved lives, whether Donald Trump should have come up with an inoculation plan that would have spared many people's lives. Those sorts of decisions that are at the heart of presidential duties, you really don't want people filing criminal cases after they leave. There's a difference between being a bad president and being a criminal one. So there is some line to be drawn. However, it cannot be the case that everything a president does, including preventing his opponent from kicking him out of office after 4 years, is subject to presidential immunity. So we'll see what Jack Smith says in his reply papers. We're now a little bit more than a month away from that outcome. What's up next? Well, Israel, of course, is always in the news. Donald Trump informs me and millions of other Jews that we are bad Jews because we will vote for Democrats. This is insulting. This is anti-Semitic. For him to say that I have to vote for him, or I don't think well of Israel, or I don't support a Jewish state, or I am a bad Jew, is really grotesque in the extreme. But that's who Donald Trump is, and he said it before. He has said this and many similar things. Excuse me. Meanwhile, Chuck Schumer made waves by giving a very blunt, very candid speech on the Senate floor in which he said, you know, it's time for Benjamin Netanyahu to go, because if he stays, we're not going to have an end to this war. We're not going to have a peace process. This was rather unusual, to put it mildly, because usually the two sides don't mix in the other's internal policies and internal politics. Now, I say that, although, if you remember, Netanyahu came and gave a speech before a joint session of Congress in order to influence a vote on the Iran deal. So it's not like his hands are clean. But it was unusual, and it was important. And that is because there is an overwhelming consensus in Israel that he must go. He only has about 15% support. So 85% of the Israeli people know he has to go. They've lost confidence in him. They lost confidence when the attack happened and they were unprepared. They lost confidence when the military didn't show up, in some cases, for days. They lost confidence when he has been fighting a war of what seems like attrition, in which the victims are overwhelmingly Palestinian civilians. He seems bent on pursuing that rather than on rescuing the remaining hostages, who, God willing, are still alive. They have been fed up with him. He is a menace to Israeli society. He's a menace to the U.S.-Israeli relationship. And as supportive as the president has been, he, without exactly commenting on Schumer's speech, did say it was a fine speech. It was a good speech. That's quite a statement from a president who is arguably the most pro-Zionist president we've ever had. So there is a lot going on, and we haven't even talked about Ukraine, which is still waiting for its aid, if Republicans can ever get off the stick. But we see slowly, slowly the wheels of justice turning, and I remain more optimistic than many about the election, simply because Donald Trump is so dangerous, so outspoken about his evil plans, so obviously ludicrous, so obviously racist and illogical and really deeply damaged, that over time, I do think the American people are going to pick up on it, or at least enough Americans will pick up on it. So I remain optimistic about the election, and maybe we'll get one or two trials along the way. We are reaching an inflection point in the history of the United States. Are we going to go down the road of Donald Trump and his view of America in the world, which is to cozy up to dictators, to abandon our alliances, to invite a destruction of NATO? Or are we going to keep our bearings and continue a bipartisan, what has been a bipartisan consensus on American democracy and American foreign policy? This is not an abstract issue. It is front and center now, and it'll be front and center in November. And in some ways, the war in Ukraine is the perfect distillation of a number of problems that we have. We have, on one hand, an irresponsible Republican Party that seems to prioritize gamesmanship and performance over doing their jobs. We face a public that has an attention span of a flea and seems uninspired, disinterested in the fate of brave patriots who are fighting for their country. And we are in a contest with that very same dictatorship, with Russia and its like-minded friends in China and elsewhere. What is going to be the desirable governing philosophy around the globe? Is it going to be the Chinese-Russian model, or is it going to be the American model? It used to be unquestioned which direction we were on, whose side we were on, whether you had a Republican or a Democrat. And that has changed dramatically. And I think there's no better person to explain this than Max Boot, who is a historian, a journalist, really a authority on military history as well as political history. He is a renowned author, as I said, and he is working on a fabulous new biography of Ronald Reagan. So without further ado, Max, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
It is my pleasure. It's my pleasure. So I have to start by asking you about your recent trip to Ukraine. Where were you and what did you see there?
I was all over the country. It was like a 1,200-mile trek from the south, Odessa, up to up through Kherson, up to Dnipro, up to Kharkiv, which is Ukraine's second largest city, then over to Kiev, and then finally out back to Poland via Lviv, having started in Moldova and winding up in Poland. So it was a really fascinating look at the whole country. I'd been to Kiev before, but hadn't been to the other places. And it was truly inspirational in many ways, because I saw how the Ukrainian people are holding up under more than 2 years of war. And, you know, it's remarkable to see, even relatively close to the front lines in Kharkiv or other places, normal life goes on. Even when that means in Kharkiv, it means that they had to open elementary schools and subway stations because the Russian attacks are so heavy that it's not safe to go to normal schools. But the Ukrainian people show a tremendous amount of resilience. They're surviving. Again, a surprising degree of normality in their lives away from frontline areas. But at the same time, it's also a reminder of how fragile this is, because we were, you know, constantly interrupted by air raid sirens. And that's a constant reminder that the war has not disappeared. And, you know, we had to go into the shelter at various points. But, you know, I wasn't that worried about it, because I know that Ukraine has pretty strong air defenses at the moment. But it may not for much longer, because if USA doesn't come through, they won't be able to restock their air defense systems. And the Russians may start causing more damage. And we saw damage that the Russians had caused. I mean, we saw bombed out apartment buildings, including one that was hit while we were there. So this is a constant danger that the Ukrainian people face. And of course, you know, on the front lines, shortly after I was there, the town of Avdiivka fell, the largest Russian gain since May of last year. And that was largely because the Ukrainians just didn't have enough artillery ammunition to keep up with the Russian attack. And that's another reminder of what can happen if the United States doesn't supply the Ukrainians. And it was just, you know, it was just so, on one level, it was really heartening to me to see the wonderful resistance of the Ukrainians. And on the other hand, it was enraging to see that their very national survival may be imperiled by these know-nothing MAGA Republicans in Washington, who have never been to Ukraine and never seen for themselves the valor of the Ukrainians or the atrocities being perpetrated by the Russians.
And I do want to get to that, absolutely. But let me ask you, from the Ukrainian perspective, are they feeling abandoned by the West? Are they bewildered by our behavior? Or are they kind of keeping a stiff upper lip and holding, you know, out hope for the best?
They're certainly monitoring developments very closely and with great concern. And this was something I heard all over the country. It wasn't just in Kyiv, and it wasn't just with senior government officials. It was with ordinary people saying, what's America going to do? Because they know that they are truly dependent for their national survival on American support. And it's not just material support. It's also psychological support, because they want very much to feel that they are part of the West and that the West stands with them. Because they know that otherwise there's no way they can defeat a much larger country like Russia. And so, yeah, I got questions from ordinary Ukrainians about what's Congress going to do. They're paying very close attention to our legislative process, and they're very concerned about what's going to happen, because they know that their survival as a country and as individuals is going to depend on these decisions being made in faraway Washington.
You know, Max and I, for listeners who don't know, spent most of our adult lives in the Republican Party. At least from my perspective, a large part of that, and unlike you, I was born here, my parents were born here, was because they fought and frankly helped win the Cold War. I thought there was nothing more important than the vindication of democracy and freedom over the forces of oppression. And it is just astounding, not only to see them be isolationist, but really to kind of be on the side of Russia. It's as if, you know, Charles Lindbergh wasn't simply advocating we stay out of World War II, but was saying, go Hitler, go Hitler. I mean, are you as just simply amazed and stunned as I am by this? I mean, it's almost incomprehensible.
Absolutely. It's certainly incomprehensible for somebody like me. I mean, as you were alluding, I wasn't as lucky as you were. I wasn't born in this country. I was born in the Soviet Union. I came here when I was 6 years old in 1976. And a lot of the reason I became a Republican in the 1980s was because I saw the Republican Party as being the party of freedom, of standing up to what Ronald Reagan called the evil empire. And, you know, that kind of moral certitude was what really drew me into the GOP. So now I'm astonished to see what's happening with the Republican Party, largely because of the influence of Trump and his followers. And as you suggested, I think it's really a reversion to a pre-Pearl Harbor Republican Party. It's really a reversion to the original America First foreign policy of the Republican Party pre-December 7th, 1941, when in fact, you know, leading figures like Charles Lindbergh, they were kind of cheerleading for Adolf Hitler. They were, you know, not only saying that America needs to stay out of European quarrels, but there was a lot of underlying sympathy for Hitler as, you know, somebody who make the trains run on time and stood up to Bolshevism and so forth. And, you know, I thought that we had moved beyond all that, and we certainly had for many decades after 1945. But, I think that Trump has unleashed something very dark and ugly in the Republican Party. And it's not, and I want to stress, this is not the whole Republican Party. This is really just the MAGA wing of the party. The Republican Party is by no means solidly behind, you know, Russia. They're not solidly against Ukraine, but they are split right down the middle, I would say, right now. And you see that in polls. You see it in congressional votes. And even just how the Republican Party being so split on whether we should help these fellow Democrats, these people in Ukraine who have been invaded for no reason whatsoever by Putin and his horrible tyrannical regime, whether we should help the Ukrainians would have been a no-brainer for any Republican that I knew growing up in the 1980s and 1990s. And now a lot of Republicans are saying, no, we should just abandon them, just as a lot of other Republicans were saying in 1940, 1941, we should just abandon the UK to the Nazis. And that's, to me, I guess you can sort of explain the historical origins of it, but it nevertheless remains horrifying and surprising.
One of the things that I think Americans may not realize, and many Republicans probably don't want to admit, is really what a critical moment this is. How close is Ukraine to the brink? You noted that they've already had to abandon territory that they had won. How desperate are things there?
I think things are pretty desperate. I mean, it's hard to know for sure because obviously the Ukrainians don't publicize how much ammunition they have, but there are real concerns that they're running low. I mean, we know that they're getting outgunned in artillery 10, 15 to 1, and we know President Zelensky has said the Russians are gearing up for another major offensive this summer, and they've already lost Avdiivka. They've lost some villages around Avdiivka. The Ukrainians don't have very strong defensive lines, in part because They don't want to build those strong defensive lines because they feel like if they do that, they're creating a de facto border and they're conceding 20% of their country to the Russians. But because they don't have those strong defensive lines of the kind the Russians have built in their occupied territory, there is a real risk of a major Russian breakthrough that could see a crumbling of the Ukrainian lines unless the Ukrainians have enough ammunition to hold the Russians back. And I'm very concerned that without American assistance, they're not going to have enough ammunition because the Europeans right now just cannot manufacture enough to supply the Ukrainians. Right now, it takes both the U.S. and Europe to keep the Ukrainian war effort going. I think things will change somewhat in 2025 because by then, you're going to see a big boost in European and U.S. defense production. You know, Russia will have a hard time keeping up their current level of spending on the war. But right now, it's really a dire moment where Russia is really gearing up for a breakthrough and the Ukrainians are just desperately trying to hold them back. And we don't know what's going to happen if they don't get American aid, but I really don't want to find out.
It's remarkable. We don't have a single American fighting other than people who go to volunteer individually. Our military forces are not fighting in Ukraine. And really, as a percentage of our defense budget, let alone a percentage of our overall budget, this investment has degraded the Russian military far more than any other comparable investment we've ever made. Talk a little bit about the losses Russia has taken and the state of their own military and their own society, frankly, as a result of the war.
Yeah, I mean, I would say this has been the most successful American foreign policy since the end of the Cold War. It's been an awesome payoff. We spent maybe 5% or a little less of the U.S. defense budget. And in return for that, Russia has lost more than 300,000 soldiers killed and wounded. They've lost two-thirds of their pre-war tank force, roughly the same armed personnel carriers. They've lost heavily across the board. I mean, their military is getting walloped. They are suffering massive setbacks. And every single, you know, Russian tank that is destroyed in Ukraine, every single Russian soldier who is killed in Ukraine, that's one less soldier, one less tank to threaten NATO allies like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, so many others who are so terrified of a Russian attack. And we're, you know, we're able to basically degrade the Russian threat in Ukraine with, as you said, without risking a single American life. It's a tremendous investment. The Ukrainians have far outperformed expectations. I mean, they have really developed a kick-ass military that has made tremendously good use of all the disparate weapon systems they've gotten from the West. This is not like an issue of Iraq or Afghanistan. There is no question about the Ukrainians being willing to fight. They have 90%+ of the public behind them. They have a democratic president and parliament. You know, the cause is righteous. The army is skilled. The Ukrainian people are brave and dedicated. They make tremendous use of our weapon systems, and they're doing tremendous damage to the Russians. But unfortunately, you know, Putin runs a complete dictatorship, and he's been able to conscript more men and ramp up defense industry, put the Russian economy on a war footing. So there's no way that Ukraine can possibly defend itself against this much larger attacker without the kind of aid that we provide. And I think, as you're suggesting, I think it's very much in our interest to continue providing that aid, because it's not just an act of charity, although it is saving a lot of Ukrainian lives, but it's also an act of American self-defense. The Ukrainians are fighting the Russians, so our own troops don't have to.
When we look at how we got to where we are, we can look back, frankly, beyond this president and beyond the former president, that Russia made gains and invaded neighbors without much consequence. Looking back on that, was that a mistake or a lack of foresight by the United States in not making a bigger stand when they went to Georgia, when they went to Crimea? Looking back, what should we have done?
Yeah, clearly it was a huge miscalculation. I think every president going back prior to Biden operated on the assumption that he could win over Putin and that, you know, he could make Putin cease and desist from his aggressive behavior and reach some kind of accommodation with him. And you remember George W. Bush infamously said that he looked in Putin's eyes and saw his soul. And so, you know, for a variety of reasons, we didn't react that strongly when he attacked Georgia, when he intervened in Syria. You know, the Obama administration wanted to do a reset with Putin. Trump came in thinking that Putin was going to be his friend. It's just been, you know, one miscalculation after another. And I think the message that Putin got from that was that he could attack with impunity, that you know, to quote Osama bin Laden, that America was a weak horse or a paper tiger, and that we were not going to stand up for our allies. And certainly we did very little when Putin attacked Ukraine the first time around in 2014, when he illegally seized Crimea and attacked the Donbass. And the Obama administration didn't even send weapons to Ukraine. They only sent non-lethal aid. And so that keeps encouraging him to go further and further. And I just hope that we can draw the line in Ukraine right now, because if we don't, I really fear what's next. I mean, if you listen to Putin's deranged interview with Tucker Carlson, he kept going on and on about Poland. He seems to be obsessed with Poland. And he was speaking very sympathetically about the Nazi invasion of Poland. He was suggesting that Poland caused, you know, the Nazi invasion of its own country, that it was responsible for the German attack. So, you know, Putin clearly has a messianic streak, and he is bent on reassembling the historic Russian Empire. And let's remember, the Baltic republics were part of that. Finland was part of that. Poland was part of that. So we better stop him in Ukraine right now. Otherwise, we don't know where he's going to go next.
When we look at Putin and we look at kind of the state of the economy and the losses they've had, which although they lie about, there are families of those people who know their loved ones were killed. Americans have a hard time understanding how strong his grip remains on power. And there always seems to be the hope that, you know, someone will take him out, a military figure, an oligarch. Explain how it is that he remains so entrenched and that the losses in the war really have not significantly affected his grip on power.
Well, a lot of the people who might have opposed Putin have left the country, understandably. Hundreds of thousands have fled. And, you know, he's really cracked down his police state. I would say he's sort of gone from, you know, authoritarianism to quasi-totalitarianism. I mean, he's certainly the strongest individual ruler in Russia since the days of Stalin, which tells you something. And, you know, he last year he got rid of Yevgeny Prigozhin, the mercenary leader who challenged him. This year, he got rid of Alexei Navalny, the leading dissident and opposition politician in Russia. So Putin has clearly consolidated his grip. And so I think we're smoking something if we think that he's going to get overthrown tomorrow or there's going to be a massive backlash against the war. He clearly seems to be in control. But nevertheless, the assessment of the U.S. intelligence community, from what I've been able to learn, is that they think that Putin is going to have trouble continuing his war effort at the current level into next year, not because there's going to be a popular rebellion, but because there are simply limits to his ability to extract more resources out of his economy amid, you know, tough Western sanctions. They do take a toll, even if they haven't stopped the Russian onslaught. And his ability just to, he's still expending more munitions than he's manufacturing. And he's having, you know, he's had some trouble mobilizing soldiers. He hasn't had a mass mobilization since the fall of 2022 because he knows it's unpopular. He really wants the marginal men in Russian society from poor villages outside of the center of power. He wants those people to be the conscripts or prisoners or others. He doesn't want to have to round up a lot of young men in Moscow and St. Petersburg because he knows that could bring a major backlash. So, yeah, I mean, I think he's in complete control of Russian society for the time being, but I think there are still constraints on his ability to wage war, which will become more pronounced over time. And I think as you saw with those brave demonstrations by people at Alexei Navalny's funeral, there's still a lot of people who understand what an awful human being and what a terrible leader Putin is, and a lot of Russians who are still willing to say and do the right thing. And so that desire for freedom has not gone away. It's just been suppressed by Putin's draconian police state.
And I don't know if Americans appreciate, you know, thousands of people turned out that funeral. There were mounds of flowers that were dropped there. And now Putin's thugs are systematically going through videotape to arrest and haul away people who went. So that's the kind of society they are. And to see someone who could very well be back in power next year drooling over this guy, elevating him, lionizing him, is just beyond comprehension to me. And to invite Putin to invade NATO. By the way, this is asking him essentially to invade us because, as you know from Article 5, an invasion against one, an attack on one is attack against all of us. So this is mind-blowing. This is, you know, treasonous in the lay term of the word. How in the world do you think he has gotten to this point? And what are Americans missing here? I mean, do people just not care in America anymore?
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder. I think we're both kind of scratching our heads. I mean, nothing seems to matter, right? The fact that Trump is rooting for this evil dictator who invaded his neighbor doesn't seem to matter. You know, his conviction in a case, alleging that he committed sexual assault doesn't seem to matter. The fact that he's been indicted on 91 felony charges doesn't seem to matter. The fact that he incited an insurrection against the United States and tried to overthrow a free election, nothing seems to matter. I mean, I don't understand. I mean, honestly, I mean, I've lived in this country for almost my entire life, for, you know, almost 50 years. And there are times when I think I just don't understand this country. I mean, I thought I did, but I feel like I really don't. And even like a couple of years ago, if you told me that Trump was going to be indicted 91 times and he was going to see an increase in popularity as a result, I wouldn't have believed it. But that is kind of where we're at. And I mean, just the fact that however you interpret recent polls, and obviously there's a lot of controversy, but I would say, you know, he's certainly got a 50-50 chance of becoming elected president. And and the fact that he has any chance, the fact that he would have, I would be shocked if he had like a 10% chance, to say nothing of like a 50% chance. I don't understand how people can vote for this guy and ignore his record or his deranged, you know, promises to seek retribution and tear up the Constitution, all this other stuff. I mean, do they just not know? Do they not care? For some people, it's a selling point. It's all just, you know, so appalling. I have to just pray that there is some good sense left in this country when the actual election rolls around.
It is appalling and disappointing that, you know, that we live in a country that is a hairbreadth away from really going over the edge, and has already adopted and normalized, you know, all of this behavior that is so horrendous and so objectionable. Let me change gears to a happier time. We thought it was a dangerous time, but it was a happier time. You are working on a book on the life and legend of Ronald Reagan. You're a brave man, Max. It's not like people haven't written about Reagan. Let's start with why you decided to take this topic on. You've written fabulous books, award-winning books on other topics. What drove you to go back to really kind of the inspiration for a lot of modern conservatism before Trump came along was Ronald Reagan?
Well, you're right that there's a lot of books about Ronald Reagan, but there has still not been a good biography about him. And that was really what led me to launch this project 10 years ago on the assumption that enough time and perspective had passed that it was possible to write a more objective biography. I could talk to a lot of people who knew Ronald Reagan, but didn't necessarily have an incentive anymore to uphold the party line. They could sort of, you know, give their honest assessment. A lot of documents were coming available at the Reagan Library. And so I thought there was a need and an opportunity to write the definitive biography of him. And that's what I've tried to do over the course of the last 10 years. And the product is this book called Reagan, His Life and Legend, which will be out in September. And I think it has a lot to say about Ronald Reagan, but I think it also has some interesting insights and takeaways for the present moment.
What about going back with some distance, not only because the eyewitnesses and the documents give you perspective, but because we're in the era that we are? What surprises you, or what surprises did you find when you went back in to dig into Ronald Reagan?
There were a lot of surprises. I was surprised by A, how ideological Reagan was when he was out of office, and B, how pragmatic he was when he was in office. I mean, I was really interested to see how far to the right he was. Like, for example, in the early 1960s, when he was routinely predicting that every social welfare piece of social welfare legislation was going to lead America to communism, that, you know, he was predicting that Medicare and Medicaid would lead to totalitarianism in America, the complete loss of freedom in America, which was the kind of talk you heard like from the John Birch Society in those days. And it's the kind of kooky talk you hear today from Donald Trump and a lot of MAGA Republicans who are constantly accusing Democrats of having some plot to turn this country communist. So, you know, it was, disappointing to see the extent to which Ronald Reagan perpetuated that kind of extremist rhetoric. But it was heartening to see the extent to which he did not act on that rhetoric when he was in office as governor of California and as president of the United States. He actually turned out to be a good governor and a good president. And that's not just me saying that. I mean, for example, I talked to Jerry Brown, the son of the man that Reagan defeated to become governor of California in 1966, and his successor as governor, who said Ronald Reagan was a good governor. I mean, I think that was a generally received opinion, just as I think you know, historians now rate Reagan as one of the top 10 presidents. And the way he achieved that success was not by holding on to this rigid ideology, but by being very pragmatic, being able to make deals in Sacramento with Jesse Unruh, the Speaker of the California Assembly, in Washington with Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House, and then, of course, with Mikhail Gorbachev after Gorbachev came to power in the Soviet Union. A lot of conservatives argue that Reagan bankrupted the Soviet Union and brought it down with his defense spending. I don't think that's actually what happened. What happened was he got very lucky and fortunate that Gorbachev came to power in 85, and Gorbachev was determined to transform the Soviet Union into a kinder, gentler country, if you like. But very much to Reagan's credit, he understood that Gorbachev was a different kind of communist, that Gorbachev was somebody he could do business with, which a lot of people on the right completely denied, including Reagan's own defense secretary. And so, you know, I think you have to give Reagan a lot of props for his willingness to govern from the center right in a very pragmatic fashion that was not designed to cater to his base, but he, as he always said, just to do what was right for the country. And he usually did that.
A perception of Reagan, both at the time and in retrospect, that he was kind of out of it, kind of doddering, wasn't too bright, was lazy. Where do you come out on his sort of command of the office, his command of the facts? Was he engaged? Was he in full command of what was going on?
I mean, he certainly knew what was going on, and he was well informed about things that interested him. He knew a lot about, you know, SDI and tax cuts. Those were issues near and dear to his heart. I think that, you know, the problem with Reagan was that he was a great leader, but a poor manager. He did not really have any managerial experience when he became governor, and his only real managerial experience as president was being governor. But he had a very hands-off managerial style where he often did not know what his aides were doing. And sometimes that worked out very well when he had good aides. I mean, for example, his first term was very successful because he had Jim Baker as White House chief of staff, and Baker was probably the most successful chief of staff ever. He did a tremendous job of doing what Reagan wanted and running the government. But, you know, he got into trouble in his second term when he had Don Regan as chief of staff, and Regan was a terrible chief of staff. And so then you had the Iran-Contra affair happen while Regan was chief of staff, and you know, Reagan signed off on things and didn't know about things, and it became a kind of a disaster. So he was certainly smart enough to be president. He read a lot, certainly a lot more than Donald Trump. But he had, you know, he was also didn't know a lot about policy, and he was largely oblivious to the specifics of governance, which sometimes was a strength because he could kind of see the big picture, but sometimes it was a weakness because he allowed corruption or mismanagement to occur on his watch. So, you know, his record was certainly mixed, in you know, probably middling to poor in the management department, but he certainly got A pluses in leadership because, you know, coming from Hollywood, coming from a show business background, he knew how to communicate. He knew how to inspire the nation. And that was his greatest strength as a leader.
You know, there was a wonderful biography by my colleague at the Post, our colleague at the Post, Karen Tumulty, on Nancy Reagan and her absolute critical role. What conclusions did you reach about her and their relationship? Obviously, a great love match, but how instrumental was she in helping to make Ronald Reagan Ronald Reagan and into helping to manage the presidency?
Well, I think Karen's biography of Nancy Reagan was a tremendous achievement, and I don't dispute a single word that she wrote in that. I think she nailed the story. But, you know, for my own research, I know talking to Stu Spencer, who was Reagan's longtime political consultant going back to 1966. Stu ran every single winning campaign that Ronald Reagan ran. And so he knew both Ronald and Nancy Reagan very well. And what Stu said to me was that, you know, something that other Reagan aides said as well, that Ronald Reagan would have never been president without Nancy Reagan, that he certainly had a lot of the leadership potential. He had the communication skills. He was a great, not only great speech giver, but a great speech writer. But she brought a toughness to their relationship that he lacked, that she was kind of the chief personnel officer of Reagan Inc., that she was able to hire and fire on his behalf in a way that he was too tenderhearted to do. And he was always very trusting and optimistic to the point of being Pollyannish. It sometimes drove her nuts that he could never see the bad side of anybody or any situation. But that was his strength in communicating with the country. He was very much alike in that respect with his early idol, FDR, very similar personalities. But Nancy really brought that toughness. And she worried. I mean, they were kind of opposites in that respect. Ronald Reagan didn't worry about anything. Nancy Reagan worried about everything. But together, they were a pretty good match, a great match, in fact. And it wasn't just a great love match. It was also a tremendously successful recipe for governance.
That is fascinating. One of the things that so contrasts Reagan and the present Republican Party was obviously his position on immigration. In ways that so struck me as someone who, although I was born in this country, had relatives who came to this country who believed in kind of the American dream, he really got the essence, which is now quoted by Nancy Pelosi in his exit, talking about the promise of America and immigration. Talk a little bit about his view of immigration, but also of race. The Republican Party has always, both parties have had a strain of racism, and yet he did help supervise the reinstitution of the Voting Rights Act. He did have people in his cabinet of various backgrounds. How do you come out on his perspective on race and on immigration?
I would say his record on immigration was much better than his record on race. His record on race, frankly, was not great. And in many ways, it kind of paved the way for today's Republican Party, because he opposed civil rights legislation. He opposed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. He opposed the 1965 Voting Rights Act. In California, he opposed the Rumford Fair Housing Act. That was, in fact, a lot of the way that he defeated Pat Brown to become governor of California in 1966. He consistently catered to white backlash politics with the help of allies like Jesse Helms. People remember that in 1980, the first major stop he made after the Republican convention was at the Neshoba County Fair in Mississippi, which was a notorious hotbed of racists, where three civil rights workers had been murdered in the 1960s. He tried to water down civil rights legislation when he was in office. So there was a reason why he had so little support in the African-American community. He certainly did not engage in the kind of open, race baiting that a George Wallace or somebody like that did. But there was certainly a sense throughout his career that he was sort of giving a wink and a nudge to this white backlash politics that had developed since the mid-1960s. But his record on immigration was very different. He was very pro-immigration, and he even refused to speak about quote-unquote illegal aliens. He wanted to call them undocumented immigrants. He began his 1980 campaign with an appearance at Liberty State Park in New Jersey with the Statue of Liberty in the background, and much of his speech was a tribute to immigrants and how wonderful they were and how they had made America. And that was a consistent theme. And remember, he signed in 1986 the Simpson-Mazzoli immigration bill, which was the most significant immigration bill we've had to date, which legalized the large number of undocumented immigrants who had previously arrived in this country, and it would be anathema to Republicans today. So very pro-immigration, I would say, kind of a mixed record on race, even though he always claimed he had no bigotry in his nature and talked about how his dad and taught him not to be a racist and so forth. But nevertheless, whether he was personally a racist or not, he certainly catered to a lot of people who were in the Republican base and won a lot of those people over from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party in the 1980s.
One of the questions I get a lot, you probably get it a lot too, is this issue of whether the Republican Party evolved into Trump, or whether Trump is some huge demarcation from the past. And I kind of try to split that into two things. I think the authoritarianism, the anti-democracy, the willingness to destroy American institutions is a sharp departure. But I think, as you alluded to, this racist strain, a sort of suspicion verging on hostility to operational government, has been in the Republican Party for a while, and Reagan, to some degree, reflected those. How do you come out on that? Is Trump a departure, or is he part of a trend kind of discussion?
My answer is yes. He is a departure, but he is also part of a trend. You know, I think the Republican Party took a major turn. The modern Republican Party was really created in 1964. It really took a major turn to the right with Barry Goldwater. You know, and we tend to remember Barry Goldwater from the 1990s, at least those of us of our age remember him from the 1990s, when he was kind of a benign figure who was on the outskirts of the Republican Party, kind of libertarian. But in 1964, you know, he was a guy who was calling for lobbing a nuke into the men's room of the Kremlin, who was voted against civil rights legislation. He was a very hard-edged conservative, and he was anathema to a lot of centrist Republicans. But he, he took over the party in 64. And basically what's happened ever since, roughly speaking, is that every generation of Republicans has been further to the right than the previous one. And Ronald Reagan was certainly further to the right than Nixon or Ford. And Donald Trump, in turn, is much further to the right than Ronald Reagan. So there's a lot of differences, but kind of the direction, I think, was really set in 1964. But, you know, there's no question that there are also, you know, huge differences, including on things like opposing Russian imperialism and supporting NATO. I mean, those are both bedrock beliefs for Ronald Reagan and really for the entire World War II generation, because they saw where isolationism led in 1941. And, you know, Ronald and Donald Trump is completely reverting back, as we discussed, to that pre-1942 Republican Party. So that's a huge change. And I think, as you suggested, Donald Trump's authoritarianism, I think, is a big change, because Ronald Reagan was certainly a believer in democracy. I couldn't imagine that he would be leading an insurrection. He wasn't trying to overthrow Democrats. He was cutting deals with Democrats because he was such a core believer in democracy. So I agree. I think it's there are some disturbing continuities, but there are also a number of discontinuities with Trump.
And I also think that, for better or worse, all the Republican presidents and all the Democratic presidents until Donald Trump really tried to be decent human beings. They kind of understood that the presidency was a respectful and a respected institution. And if they did something bad, they had the good graces to lie about it or to cover it up. But yep, they understood that there was something required of the president. They were not psychopaths. They were not sociopaths. And it's frightful that we have one who was in office, and there are a great many people who either don't care or think, I don't know, everyone's as bad. There's a deep cynicism. What, from your kind of sweep of experience, and you've written a lot about history, you've studied history, where do you think we can expect to be? I mean, we're obviously at an inflection point. And in some senses, once democracies start, you know, throwing overboard their precious rights and institutions, it's kind of an inevitable downhill from there. But I guess the larger question is, are you optimistic about America, or are you frightened and depressed?
I'm frightened and depressed. I used to be much more optimistic about America. But again, as we're discussing, when somebody like Donald Trump, who has been so discredited and is such a charlatan and budding dictator, when he's running even with Joe Biden, who's, yeah, he's old, but he's a decent guy who's doing a good job, that to me says something very disturbing about America. And I think, you know, Trump is really shattering the norms and guardrails of American politics and American society. And unfortunately, he's kind of drawing a roadmap for future demagogues to follow. And you could imagine the J.D. Vances and Josh Hawleys and folks of a younger generation who are going to be trying to pick up where Donald Trump left off. And that to me is very dismaying. I never thought that the future of democracy in America would be up for grabs, but it really is.
Well, at the gulag, Max, I'll get the top bunk, you can get the bottom bunk, and we'll play a lot of pinochle when we're out there. It has been an absolute pleasure. I can't tell you how much I am looking forward to your book. We'll have you back when it is out. Thank you for all you do, and thank you for writing such wonderful, engaging history. It's really just a joy to read what you write.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to have this discussion and a pleasure to always read your writing in the Washington Post.
And that was Max Boot. Wow. What an interesting discourse on democracy, America, the Ukraine war, Ronald Reagan, and it is disturbing because in prior elections before 2016, you could vote for one candidate or the other candidate and be upset if your guy lost, but be reasonably certain that the country was going to be just fine. Back when I was a Republican, I voted for John McCain. I thought he was a heroic figure. I thought he was a stalwart patriot and defender of freedom around the world. But when he lost, I knew that the country would be fine, that Barack Obama was a good and decent man, and that whatever strengths and weaknesses he had, he was not going to attack the foundations of our country. We no longer have that luxury. We no longer have the luxury of assuming that whoever is in office is going to care about American democracy, about decent behavior, about alliances, about a world order that keeps us secure and keeps us prosperous. Everything is literally, it's actually not literally, it is actually up for grabs. We are facing an existential question. And we're not going to get the Supreme Court to get us out of this and dispense with Donald Trump. We're not going to have some intervention from on high. This is us. This is the American people. And what Max and I were belaboring a bit was our sense of disbelief and disappointment in our fellow Americans. Not those of you who have the wherewithal and the interest to listen to a program like this, or even people who disagree with what I have to say, but are informed, are patriotic, have definite ideas about how to improve America. I'm talking about the millions and millions who seem to either have checked out or have affirmatively thrown their lot in with an authoritarian. Yeah, we need a strong man. Yeah, this democracy is too much of a hassle. We never thought, Max and I, that we would live in a country in which that is in doubt. When you look back on those grainy images of the Nazi gatherings and you see a brainwashed public and you say, oh, America would never fall prey to that. You know, look at those crazy Europeans getting wrapped up with a dictator who's clearly out of his gourd. Well, we are us. That is us. That's what we're facing. The masses do not wear red and black armbands. They wear red hats, but it's the same. And we have to, if we cannot persuade them, we have to outvote them, because nothing less than the survival of American democracy and the American experiment is at risk. So keep alert, keep working for democracy, keep reading, and keep an eye out for Max's book. I know it's going to be terrific and revelatory. And if you like this program and you like our other programs, please tell your friends. They can follow, they can subscribe to Jen Rubin's Green Room at Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.